Chapter 7 Every Man Jack. Silas had been preoccupied for the previous several months. He had begun to leave the graveyard for days, sometimes weeks at a time. Over Christmas, Miss Lupescu had come out for 3 weeks in his place, and Bod had shared her meals in her little flat in the old town. She had even taken him to a football match, as Silas had promised that she would, but she had gone back to the place she called the old country, after squeezing Bod's cheeks and calling him Nimini, which had become her pet name for him. Now Silas was gone, and Miss Lupescu also. Mr. and Mrs. Owens were sitting in Josiah Worthington's tomb, talking to Josiah Worthington. None of them was happy.
"You mean to say that he did not tell either of you where he was going, or how the child was to be cared for?"
When the Owenses shook their heads.
"Well, where is he?"
Neither Owens was able to answer.
"He's never been gone for so long before. And he promised, when the child came to us, promised he would be here, or someone else would be here to help us care for him. He promised."
"I worry that something must have happened to him."
She seemed close to tears, and then her tears turned to anger.
"This is too bad of him. Is there no way to find him, to call him back?"
"None that I know, but I believe that he's left money in the crypt for food for the boy."
"Money? What use is money?"
"Bod will be needing money if he's to go out there to buy food,"
began Mr. Owens, but Mrs. Owens turned on him.
"You're all as bad as each other."
She left the Worthington tomb then, and she went looking for her son, whom she found, as she expected to, at the top of the hill, staring out over the town.
"Penny for your thoughts?"
"You don't have a penny."
He was 14 now, and taller than his mother.
"I've got 2 in the coffin. Probably a bit green by now, but I've still got them right enough."
"I was thinking about the world. How do we even know that the person who killed my family is still alive? That he's out there?"
"Silas says he is."
"But Silas doesn't tell us anything else."
"He means only the best for you. You know that."
"Thanks. So where is he?"
Mrs. Owens made no reply.
"You saw the man who killed my family, didn't you? On the day you adopted me?"
Mrs. Owens nodded.
"What was he like?"
"Mostly I had eyes for you. Let me see. He had dark hair, very dark, and I was frightened of him. He had a sharp face. Hungry and angry all at once he was. Silas saw him off."
"Why didn't Silas just kill him? He should have just killed him then."
Mrs. Owens touched the back of Bod's hand with her cold fingers.
"He's not a monster, Bod."
"If Silas had killed him back then, I would be safe now. I could go anywhere."
"Silas knows more than you do about all this, more than any of us do. And Silas knows about life and death. It's not that easy."
"What was his name? The man who killed them?"
"He didn't say it. Not then."
Bod put his head on one side and stared at her with eyes as grey as thunderclouds.
"But you know it, don't you?"
"There's nothing you can do, Bod."
"There is. I can learn. I can learn everything I need to know, all I can. I learned about ghoul gates. I learned to dreamwalk. Miss Lupescu taught me how to watch the stars. Silas taught me silence. I can haunt. I can fade. I know every inch of this graveyard."
Mrs. Owens reached out a hand, touched her son's shoulder.
"One day,"
she hesitated, "one day, she would not be able to touch him. One day, he would leave them. One day."
"Silas told me the man who killed your family was called Jack.
Bod said nothing. Then he nodded.
Mother?
What is it, son?
When will Silas come back?
The midnight wind was cold, and it came from the north. Mrs. Owens was no longer angry. She feared for her son.
I wish I knew, my darling boy. I wish I knew.
Scarlett Amber Perkins was 15, and at that moment, sitting on the upper deck of the elderly bus, she was a mass of angry hate. She hated her parents for splitting up. She hated her mother for moving away from Scotland. Hated her father because he didn't seem to care that she had gone. She hated this town for being so different. Nothing like Glasgow, where she had grown up. And she hated it because every now and again she would turn a corner and see something, and the world would all become achingly, horribly familiar. She had lost it with her mother that morning.
At least in Glasgow I had friends,
Scarlett had said, and she wasn't quite shouting, and she wasn't quite sobbing.
I'll never see them again.
All her mother had said in reply was,
at least you're somewhere you've been before. I mean, we lived here when you were little.
I don't remember. And it's not like I still know anyone. Do you want me to find my old friends from when I was 5? Is that what you want?
Well, I'm not stopping you.
Scarlett had gone through the whole of the school day angry. And she was angry now. She hated her school, and she hated the world. And right now she particularly hated the town bus service. Every day, when school was over, the 97 bus to the city centre would take her from her school gates all the way to the end of the street where her mother had rented a small flat. She had waited at the bus stop on that gusty April day for almost half an hour, and no 97 buses had appeared. So, when she saw a 121 bus, with city centre as its destination, she had climbed aboard. But where her bus always turned right, this one turned left, into the old town, past the municipal gardens in the old town square, past the statue of Josiah Worthington, baronet, and then crept up a winding hill lined with high houses as Scarlett's heart sank. And her anger was replaced with misery. She walked downstairs, edged forward, eyed the sign telling her not to speak to the driver when the vehicle was in motion, and said,
excuse me, I wanted to go to Acacia Avenue.
The driver, a large woman, her skin even darker than Scarlett's, said,
you should have got the 97 then.
But this goes to the city centre.
Eventually. But even when you get there, you'll still need to get back. Best thing you can do? Get off here, walk back down the hill. There's a bus stop in front of the town hall. From there, you can catch the number 4 or the 58. Both of them will take you most of the way to Acacia Avenue. You could get off by the sports centre and walk up from there. You got all that?
The 4 or the 58?
I'll let you off here.
It was a request stop on the side of the hill, just past a large pair of open iron gates. And it looked uninviting and dismal. Scarlett stood in the open doorway of the bus until the bus driver said,
go on, hop it.
She stepped down onto the pavement, and the bus belched black smoke and roared away. The wind rattled the trees on the other side of the wall. Scarlett began to walk back down the hill. This was why she needed a mobile phone, she thought. If she was so much as 5 minutes late, her mother would freak. But she still wouldn't buy Scarlett a phone of her own. Oh, well, she would have to endure another shouting match. It wouldn't be the first, and it wouldn't be the last. By now she was level with the open gates. She glanced inside and...
that's odd,
there's an expression, déjà vu, that means that you feel like you've been somewhere before, that you've somehow already dreamed it or experienced it in your mind. Scarlett had experienced it. The knowledge that a teacher was just about to tell them that she'd been to Inverness on holiday, or that someone had dropped a spoon in just that way before. This was different. This wasn't a feeling that she had been here before. This was the real thing. Scarlett walked through the open gates into the graveyard. A magpie flew up as she walked in, a flash of black and white and iridescent green, and settled in the branches of a yew tree, watching her.
Around that corner is a church with a bench in front of it.
And she turned a corner to see a church, much smaller than the one in her head, a sinister, blocky little Gothic building of grey stone with a jutting spire. In front of it was a weathered wooden bench. She walked over, sat down on the bench, and swung her legs as if she was still a little girl.
Hello? Hello?
Said a voice from behind her.
Awful cheek of me, I know, but would you help me hold down this... just really need another pair of hands, if it's not too much trouble.
Scarlett looked around and saw a man in a fawn-coloured raincoat squatting in front of a gravestone. He was holding a large sheet of paper which was blowing about in the wind. She hurried over to him.
You hold on to it here. One hand here. One hand there. That's it. Frightful imposition, I know. Ridiculously grateful.
He had a biscuit tin next to him, and from the tin he pulled what looked like a crayon, the size of a small candle. He began rubbing it back and forth across the stone with easy practice movements.
There we go. And here she comes. Whoops! A wiggly bit down at the bottom here. I think it's meant to be ivy. The Victorians loved putting ivy on things. Deeply symbolic, you know. And there we are. You can let go now.
He stood up, ran one hand through his grey hair.
Ah! Needed to stand. Legs got a bit pins and needlesy. So, what do you reckon to that?
The actual headstone was covered in green and yellow lichen, and so worn and faded as to almost be undecipherable. But the rubbing was clear.
Magilla Godspeed, spinster of this parish, 1791 to 1870. Lost to all but memory.
And probably now lost even to that.
His hair was thinning, and he smiled hesitantly and blinked at her through small round glasses, which made him look a little like a friendly owl. A large raindrop splashed down on the paper, and the man hurriedly rolled it up and grabbed his tin box of crayons. Another handful of raindrops, and Scarlett picked up the portfolio the man pointed to, propped up beside a nearby gravestone, and followed him into the tiny porch of the church, where the rain could not touch them.
Thank you so much. I don't think it's really going to rain much. Weather forecast for this afternoon said mostly sunny.
As if in reply, the wind gusted coldly, and the rain began to beat down in earnest.
I know what you're thinking.
You do?
She had been thinking.
My mum will kill me.
You're thinking, is this a church or a funeral chapel? And the answer is, as far as I can ascertain, that on this site there was indeed a small church, and the original graveyard would have been its churchyard. That's as long ago as 800, perhaps 900 AD, rebuilt and extended several times in there. But there was a fire here in the 1820s, and by that time it was already much too small for the area. People around here were using St. Dunstan's in the village square as their parish church. So when they came to rebuild here, they made it a funeral chapel, keeping many of the original features, The stained glass windows in the far wall are said to be original.
Actually, I was thinking that my mum is going to kill me. I got the wrong bus, and I'm already so late home.
Good Lord, you poor thing. Look, I only live just down the road. You wait here.
And with that, he thrust his portfolio, his tin of crayons, and his rolled-up sheet of paper into her hands. And he set off at a trot down to the gates, his shoulders hunched against the driving rain. A couple of minutes later, Scarlet saw the lights of a car and heard the sound of a car horn. Scarlet ran down to the gates, where she could see the car, an elderly green Mini. The man she had been talking to was sitting in the driver's seat. He wound down his window.
Come on. Where exactly am I taking you?
Scarlet stood there, the rain running down her neck.
I don't take rides from strangers.
Quite right, too. But one good turn deserves, and, all that. Here, put the stuff in the back before it gets soaked.
He pulled open the passenger door, and Scarlet leaned inside and put his grave-rubbing equipment down on the back seat as best she could.
Tell you what, why don't you phone your mother? You can use my phone and tell her my car's number plate. You can do it from inside the car. You're getting soaked out there.
Scarlet hesitated. Rain was beginning to plaster her hair down. It was cold. The man reached over and handed her his mobile phone. Scarlet looked at it. She realized she was more afraid of calling her mother than she was of getting into the car.
I could call the police too, couldn't I?
You certainly can, yes. Or you can walk home, or you can just call your mother and ask her to come and pick you up.
Scarlet got into the passenger seat and closed the door. She kept hold of the man's phone.
Where do you live?
You really don't have to. I mean, you could just take me to the bus stop.
I'll take you home. Address?
102A Acacia Avenue. It's off the main road, a wee bit past the big sports centre.
You are out of your way, aren't you? Right, let's get you home.
He took off the handbrake, swung the car around, and drove down the hill.
Been living here long?
Not really. We moved here just after Christmas. We lived here when I was 5, though.
Is that a brogue I detect in your accent?
We've been living in Scotland for 10 years. There, I sounded like everyone else. And then I came down here. And now I stick out like a sore thumb.
She had wanted it to sound like a joke, but it was true. And she could hear it as she said it. Not funny, just bitter. The man drove to Acacia Avenue, parked in front of the house, then insisted on coming up to the front door with her. When the door was opened, he said,
"Frightfully sorry. I took the liberty of bringing your daughter back to you. Obviously, you taught her well, shouldn't accept rides from strangers. But, well, it was raining, she took the wrong bus, wound up on the other side of town. Bit of a mess all round, really. So you can find it in your heart to forgive. Forgive her. And, me."
Scarlet expected her mother to shout at both of them, and was surprised and relieved when her mother only said, "Well, you couldn't be too careful these days, and was Mr. A teacher, and would he like a cup of tea?" Mr. Said his name was Frost, but she could call him Jay, and Mrs. Perkins smiled and said he could call her Noona, and she'd put the kettle on. Over tea, Scarlet told her mother the story of her wrong bus adventure, and how she had found herself at the graveyard, and how she met Mr. Frost by the little church. Mrs. Perkins dropped her teacup. They were sitting around the table in the kitchen, so the cup didn't fall very far, and it didn't break, just spilled tea. Mrs. Perkins apologized awkwardly, and went and got a cloth from the sink to mop it up.
"The graveyard on the hill? In the old town? That one?"
"I live over that way. Been doing a lot of grave rubbings. And you know, it's technically a nature reserve."
"I know. Thank you so much for giving Scarlet a ride home, Mr. Frost."
Each word might have been an ice cube.
I think you should leave now.
I say, that's a bit much. Didn't mean to hurt your feelings. Was it something I said? The rubbings, they're for a local history project. It's not as if I'm, you know, digging up bones or anything.
For a heartbeat, Scarlet thought that her mother was going to strike Mr. Frost, who just looked worried. But Mrs. Perkins shook her head.
Sorry. Family history, not your fault.
As if she was making a conscious effort, she said, brightly.
You know, Scarlet actually used to play in that graveyard when she was little. This is, 10 years ago. She had an imaginary friend, too, a little boy called Nobody.
A smile twitched at the corner of Mr. Frost's lips.
A ghosty?
No, I don't think so. He just lived there. She even pointed out the tomb he lived in. So, well, I suppose he was a ghost. Do you remember, love?
Scarlet shook her head.
I must have been a funny kid.
I'm sure that you are nothing of the... You are raising a fine girl here, Nuna. Well, lovely cup of tea. Always a joy to make new friends. I'll be toddling off now. Got to make myself a little dinner. And I've got a meeting of the local history society.
You're making your own dinner?
Yes, making it. Well, defrosting it, really. I'm also a master of the boil in the bag. Eating for one and living on my own. Bit of a crusty old bachelor. Actually, in the papers, that always means gay, doesn't it? Not gay, just never met the right woman.
And for a moment, he looked rather sad. Mrs. Perkins, who hated to cook, announced that she always cooked too much food at the weekend, and as she ushered Mr. Frost out into the hall, Scarlet heard him agree that he would love to come round for dinner on Saturday night. When Mrs. Perkins came back from the front hall, all she said to Scarlet was,
I hope you've done your homework.
Scarlet was thinking about the afternoon's events as she lay in bed that night, listening to the sound of the cars grinding their way along the main road. She had been there, in that graveyard, when she was little. That was why everything had seemed so familiar. In her mind, she imagined and she remembered. And somewhere in there she fell asleep. But in sleep, she still walked the paths of the graveyard. It was night, but she could see everything as clearly as if it were day. She was on the side of a hill. There was a boy of about her own age, standing with his back to her, looking at the lights of the city.
Boy, what are you doing?
He looked around, seemed to have trouble focusing.
Who said that? Oh, I can see you. Sort of. Are you dreamwalking?
I think I'm dreaming.
Not quite what I meant. Hello, I'm Bud.
I'm Scarlet.
He looked at her again, as if he were seeing her for the first time.
Of course you are. I knew you looked familiar. You were in the graveyard today with that man, the one with the paper.
Mr. Frost. He's really nice. He gave me a lift home. Did you see us?
Yeah. I keep an eye on most things that happen in the graveyard.
What kind of a name is Bod?
It's short for nobody.
Of course. That's what this dream is about. You're my imaginary friend from when I was little, all grown up.
He nodded. He was taller than she was. He wore grey, although she could not have described his clothes. His hair was too long, and she thought it had been some time since he had received a haircut.
You were really brave. We went deep into the hill, and we saw the indigo man, and we met the Sleer.
Something happened then, in her head. A rushing and a tumbling, a whirl of darkness, and a crash of images.
I remember.
But she said it to the empty darkness of her bedroom, and heard nothing in reply but the low trundle of a distant lorry making its way through the night. Bod had stores of food, the kind that lasted, cached in the crypt, and more in some of the chillier tombs and vaults and mausoleums. Silas had made sure of that. He had enough food to keep him going for a couple of months. Unless Silas or Miss Lupescu was there, he simply would not leave the graveyard. He missed the world beyond the graveyard gates, but he knew it was not safe out there. Not yet. The graveyard, though, was his world and his domain, and he was proud of it and loved it as only a 14-year-old boy can love anything. And yet, in the graveyard, no one ever changed. The little children Bod had played with when he was small were still little children. Fortinbras Bartleby, who had once been his best friend, was now 4 or 5 years younger than Bod was, and they had less to talk about each time they saw each other. Thackeray Porringer was Bod's height and age, and seemed to be in much better temper with him. He would walk with Bod in the evenings and tell stories of unfortunate things that had happened to his friends. Normally the stories would end in the friends being hanged until they were dead for no offence of theirs and by mistake, although sometimes they were simply transported to the American colonies and they didn't have to be hanged unless they came back. Liza Hempstock, who had been Bod's friend for the last 6 years, was different in another way. She was less likely to be there for him when Bod went down to the nettle patch to see her, and on the rare occasions when she was, she would be short-tempered, argumentative, and often downright rude. Bod talked to Mr. Owens about this, and after a few moments' reflection, his father said,
"It's just women, I reckon. She liked you as a boy, probably isn't sure who you are now you're a young man. I used to play with one little girl down by the duck pond every day until she turned about your age, and then she threw an apple at my head and did not say another word to me until I was 17.
Mrs. Owens sniffed.
"It was a pear I threw, and I was talking to you again soon enough, for we danced a measure at your cousin Ned's wedding, and that was but 2 days after your 16th birthday."
"Of course, you're right, my dear."
He winked at Bod to tell him that it was none of it serious. And then he mouthed 17 to show that, really, it was. Bod had allowed himself no friends among the living. That way, he had realized back during his short-lived school days, lay only trouble. Still, he had remembered Scarlet, had missed her for years after she went away, had long ago faced the fact he would never see her again. And now, she had been here in his graveyard, and he had not known her. He was wandering deeper into the tangle of ivy and trees that made the graveyard's northwest quadrant so dangerous. Signs advised visitors to keep out, but the signs were not needed. It was uninviting and creepy once you were past the ivy tangle that marked the end of the Egyptian walk and the black doors in the mock Egyptian walls that led to people's final resting places. In the northwest, nature had been reclaiming the graveyard for almost 100 years, and the stones were tipped over. Graves were forgotten, or simply lost beneath the green ivy and the leaf fall of 50 years. Paths were lost and impassable. Bod walked with care. He knew the area well, and he knew how dangerous it could be. When Bod was 9, he had been exploring in just this part of the world when the soil had given way beneath him, tumbling him into a hole almost 20 feet down. The grave had been dug deep to accommodate many coffins, but there was no headstone and only one coffin down at the bottom. containing a rather excitable medical gentleman named Carstairs, who seemed thrilled by Bod's arrival and insisted on examining Bod's wrist, which Bod had twisted in the tumble, grabbing onto a root, before he could be persuaded to go and fetch help. Bod was making his way through the northwest quadrant, a sludge of fallen leaves, a tangle of ivy, where the foxes made their homes, and fallen angels stared up blindly, because he had an urge to talk to the poet. Nehemiah Trott was the poet's name, and his gravestone beneath the greenery read, "Here lies the mortal remains of Nehemiah Trott, poet, 1741 to 1774. Swans sing before they die."
"Master Trott, might I ask you for advice?"
Nehemiah Trott beamed wanly.
"Of course, brave boy. The advice of poets is the cordiality of kings. How may I smear unction on your... No, not unction. How may I give balm to your pain?"
"I'm not actually in pain. I just... Well, there's a girl I used to know. And I wasn't sure if I should find her and talk to her, or if I should just forget about it."
Nehemiah Trott drew himself up to his full height, which was less than Bod's, raised both hands to his chest excitedly, and said,
"Oh, you must go to her and implore her. You must call her your Terpsichore, your Echo, your Clytemnestra. You must write poems for her, mighty odes. I shall help you write them. And thus, and only thus, shall you win your true love's heart."
"I don't actually need to win her heart. She's not my true love. Just someone I'd like to talk to."
"Of all the organs, the tongue is the most remarkable, for we use it both to taste our sweet wine and bitter poison. Thus also do we utter words both sweet and sour with the same tongue. Go to her, talk to her."
"I shouldn't."
"You should, sir. You must. I shall write about it when the battle's lost and won."
"But if I unfade for one person, it makes it easier for other people to see me."
"Ah, list to me, young Leander, young hero, young Alexander. If you dare nothing, then when the day is over, nothing is all you will have gained."
"Good point."
Bod was pleased with himself, and glad he had thought of asking the poet for advice.
"Really, if you couldn't trust a poet to offer sensible advice, who could you trust?"
Which reminded him.
"Mr. Trott, tell me about revenge."
"Dish best served cold. Do not take revenge in the heat of the moment. Instead, wait until the hour is propitious. There was a Grub Street hack named O'Leary, an Irishman, I should add, who had the nerve, the confounded cheek, to write of my first slim volume of poems, A Nosegay of Beauty Assembled for Gentlemen of Quality, that it was inferior doggerel of no worth whatsoever, and that the paper it was written on would have been better used as... No, I cannot say. Let us simply agree that it was a most vulgar statement."
"But you got your revenge on him?"
"On him? And on his entire pestilent breed. Oh, I had my revenge, Master Owens, and it was a terrible one. I wrote, and had published, a letter, which I nailed to the doors of the public houses in London where such low, scribbling folk were wont to frequent, and I explained that, given the fragility of the genius poetical, I would henceforth write, not for them, but only for myself and posterity, and that I should, as long as I lived, publish no more poems for them. Thus I left instructions that upon my death my poems were to be buried with me, unpublished, and that only when posterity realized my genius, realized that hundreds of my verses had been lost, Only then was my coffin to be disinterred. Only then could my poems be removed from my cold, dead hand, to finally be published to the approbation and delight of all. It is a terrible thing to be ahead of your time.
And after you died, they dug you up, and they printed the poems?
Not yet, no. But there is still plenty of time. Posterity is vast.
So, that was your revenge?
Indeed, and a mightily powerful and cunning one at that.
Yes.
Best served cold.
Bod left the northwest of the graveyard, returned through the Egyptian walk to the more orderly paths and untangled ways, and as the dusk fell, he wandered back towards the old chapel, not because he hoped Silas had returned from his travels, but because he had spent his life visiting the chapel at dusk, and it felt good to have a rhythm. And anyway, he was hungry. Bod slipped through the crypt door, down into the crypt. He moved a cardboard box, filled with curled and damp parish papers, and took out a carton of orange juice, an apple, a box of breadsticks, and a block of cheese. And he ate while pondering how and whether he would seek out Scarlet. He would dreamwalk, perhaps, since that was how she had come to him. He headed outside, was on his way to sit on the grey wooden bench when he saw something, and he hesitated. There was someone already there, sitting on his bench. She was reading a magazine. Bod faded even more, became a part of the graveyard, no more important than a shadow or a twig. But she looked up. She looked straight at him.
Bod, is that you?
He said nothing. Then he said,
Why? Can you see me?
I almost couldn't. At first I thought you were a shadow or something, but you look like you did in my dream. You sort of came into focus.
He walked over to the bench.
Can you actually read that? Isn't it too dark for you?
Scarlet closed the magazine.
It's odd. You'd think it would be too dark, but I could read it fine. No problem.
Are you...
He trailed off, uncertain of what he had wanted to ask her.
Are you here on your own?
She nodded.
I helped Mr. Frost do some grave rubbings after school, and then I told him I wanted to sit and think here for a bit. When I'm done here, I promised to go and have a cup of tea with him, and he'll run me home. He didn't even ask why. Just said he loves sitting in graveyards too, and that he thinks they can be the most peaceful places in the world. Can I hug you?
Do you want to?
Yes.
Well then.
He thought for a moment.
I don't mind if you do.
My hands won't go through you or anything. You're really there.
You won't go through me.
She threw her arms around him and squeezed him so tightly he could hardly breathe.
That hurts.
Scarlet let go.
Sorry.
No, it was nice. I mean... You just squeezed more than I was expecting.
I just wanted to know if you were real. All these years I thought you were just something in my head. And then I sort of forgot about you. But I didn't make you up. And you're back. You're in my head. And you're in the world too.
Bod smiled.
You used to wear a sort of a coat. It was orange. And whenever I saw that particular colour orange... I think of you. I don't suppose you still have the coat.
No, not for a long time. It would be a wee bit too small for me now.
Yes, of course.
I should go home. I thought I could come up on the weekend, though.
And then, seeing the expression on Bod's face, she said,
Today's Wednesday.
I'd like that.
She turned to go. Then she said,
How will I find you next time?
I'll find you. Don't worry. Just be on your own. and I'll find you.
She nodded and was gone. Bod walked back into the graveyard and up the hill until he reached the Frobisher Mausoleum. He did not enter it. He climbed up the side of the building, using the thick ivy root as a foothold, and he pulled himself up onto the stone roof, where he sat and thought, looking out at the world of moving things beyond the graveyard. And he remembered the way that Scarlet had held him, and how safe he had felt, if only for a moment, and how fine it would be to walk safely in the lands beyond the graveyard, and how good it was to be master of his own small world. Scarlet said that she didn't want a cup of tea, thank you, or a chocolate biscuit. Mr. Frost was concerned.
Honestly, you look like you've seen a ghost. Well, a graveyard, not a bad place to see one if you were going to, I had an aunt once who claimed her parrot was haunted. She was a Scarlet Macaw. The parrot. The aunt was an architect. Never knew the details.
I'm fine. It was just a long day.
I'll give you a lift home, then. Any idea what this says? Been puzzling over it for half an hour.
He indicated a grave rubbing on the little table, held flat by a jam jar in each corner.
Is that name Gladstone, do you think? Could be a relative of the Prime Minister. But I can't make out anything else.
Fried not. But I'll take another look when I come out on Saturday.
Is your mother likely to put in an appearance?
She said she'd drop me off here in the morning. Then she has to go and get groceries for our dinner. She's cooking a roast chicken.
Do you think there are likely to be roast potatoes?
I expect so, yes.
Mr. Frost looked delighted.
I wouldn't want to put her out of her way, I mean.
She's loving it. Thank you for giving me a lift home.
More than welcome.
They walked together down the steps in Mr. Frost's high, narrow house to the little entrance hall at the bottom of the stairs. In Krakow, on Wawel Hill, there are caves called the Dragon's Den, named after a long-dead dragon. These are the caves that the tourists know about. There are caves beneath those caves that the tourists do not know and do not ever get to visit. They go down a long way, and they are inhabited. Silas went first, followed by the grey hugeness of Miss Lupescu, padding quietly on 4 feet just behind him. Behind them was Kandar, a bandage-wrapped Assyrian mummy with powerful eagle wings and eyes like rubies, who was carrying a small pig. There had originally been 4 of them, but they had lost a rune in a cave far above, when the Ifrit, as naturally overconfident as are all of its race, had stepped into a space, bounded by 3 polished bronze mirrors, and had been swallowed up in a blaze of bronze light. In moments, the Ifrit could only be seen in the mirrors and no longer in reality. In the mirrors, his fiery eyes were wide open, and his mouth was moving as if he was shouting at them to leave and beware. And then he faded and was lost to them. Silas, who had no problems with mirrors, had covered one of them with his coat, rendering the trap useless.
So, now there are only 3 of us.
And the pig.
Why?
Asked Miss Lupescu, with a wolf tongue through wolf teeth.
Why the pig?
It's lucky.
Miss Lupescu growled, unconvinced.
Did Arun have a pig?
Hush! They are coming. From the sound of it, there are many of them.
Let them come.
Miss Lupescu's hackles were rising. She said nothing, but she was ready for them, and it was only by an effort of will that she did not throw back her head and howl.
It's beautiful up this way.
Yes.
So, your family were all killed. Does anyone know who did it?
No, not that I know. My guardian only says that the man who did it is still alive, and that he'll tell me the rest of what he knows one day.
One day?
When I'm ready.
What's he scared of? That you'd strap on your gun and ride out to wreak vengeance on the man who killed your family?
Bod looked at her seriously.
Well, obviously. Not a gun, though. But yes, something like that.
You're joking.
Bod said nothing. His lips were tight pressed together. He shook his head.
I'm not joking.
It was a bright and sunny Saturday morning. They were just past the entrance to the Egyptian walk, out of the direct sunlight, under the pines and the sprawling monkey puzzle tree.
Your guardian. Is he a dead person too?
I don't talk about him.
Scarlet looked hurt.
Not even to me?
Not even to you.
Well, be like that.
Look, I'm sorry, I didn't mean...
I promised Mr. Frost I wouldn't be too long. I'd better be getting back.
Right,
said Bod, worried he had offended her, unsure what he should say to make anything better. He watched Scarlet head off on the winding path back to the chapel. A familiar female voice said, with derision,
Look at her, Miss High and Mighty.
But there was no one to be seen. Bod, feeling awkward, walked back to the Egyptian walk. Miss Lilibet and Miss Violet had let him store a cardboard box, filled with old paperback books, in their vault, and he wanted to find something to read. Scarlet helped Mr. Frost with his grave rubbings until midday, when they stopped for lunch. He offered to buy her fish and chips as a thank you, and they walked down to the fish and chip shop at the bottom of the road, and as they walked back up the hill, they ate their steaming fish and chips, drenched in vinegar and glittering with salt out of paper bags.
If you wanted to find out about a murder, where would you look? I already tried the internet.
Depends. What kind of murder are we talking about?
Something local, I think. About 13 or 14 years ago. A family was killed around here.
Crikey. This really happened?
Oh, yes. Are you all right?
Not really. Bit too... well, bit of a wimp, really. Things like that. I mean, local true crime, you don't like to think about it. Things like that happening here. Not something I'd expect a girl of your age to be interested in.
It's not actually for me. It's for a friend.
Mr. Frost finished off the last of his fried cod.
The library, I suppose. If it's not on the internet, it'll be in their newspaper files. What set you off after this?
Oh.
Scarlet wanted to lie as little as possible.
A boy I know. He was asking about it.
Definitely the library. Murder. Ugh. Gives me the shivers.
Me too. A bit. Could you maybe, possibly, drop me off at the library this afternoon?
Mr. Frost bit a large chip in half, chewed it, and looked at the rest of the chip, disappointed.
They get cold so fast, don't they, chips? One minute you're burning your mouth on them, the next you're wondering how they cool off so quickly.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't be asking for rides everywhere.
Not at all. Just wondering how best to organise this afternoon, and whether or not your mother likes chocolates. Bottle of wine? Or chocolates? Not really sure. Both, maybe?
I can make my own way home from the library. And she loves chocolates. So do I.
Chocolates it is, then.
They had reached the middle of the row of high-terraced houses on the hill, and the little green mini parked outside.
Get in. I'll run you over to the library.
The library was a square building, all brick and stone, dating back to the beginning of the last century. Scarlet looked around and then went up to the desk.
Yes. I wanted to see some old newspaper clippings.
Is it for school?
It's local history,
said Scarlet, nodding, proud that she hadn't actually lied.
We've got the local paper on microfiche,
said the woman. She was large and had silver hoops in her ears. Scarlet could feel her heart pounding in her chest. She was certain she looked guilty or suspicious, but the woman led her into a room with boxes that looked like computer screens and showed her how to use them, to project a page of the newspaper at a time onto the screen.
One day we'll have it all digitized. Now, what dates are you after?
About 13 or 14 years ago. I can't be more specific than that. I'll know it when I see it.
The woman gave Scarlet a small box with 5 years' worth of newspapers on microfilm in it.
Go wild.
Scarlet assumed that the murder of a family would have been front-page news. But instead, when she eventually found it, it was almost buried on page 5. It had happened in October, 13 years earlier. There was no colour in the article, no description, just an understated list of events. Architect Ronald Dorian, 36, his wife Carlotta, 34, a publisher, and their daughter Misty, 7, were found dead at 33 Dunstan Road. Foul play is suspected. A police spokesman said that it was too early to comment at this stage in their investigations, but that significant leads are being followed. There was no mention of how the family died, and nothing said about a missing baby. In the weeks that followed, there was no follow-up, and the police did not ever comment. Not that Scarlet could see. But that was it. She was certain. 33 Dunstan Road. She knew the house. She had been in there. She returned the box of microfilm to the front desk, thanked the librarian, and walked home in the April sunshine. Her mother was in the kitchen, cooking. Not entirely successfully, judging from the smell of burnt bottom of the saucepan that filled most of the flat. Scarlet retreated to her bedroom and opened the windows wide to let the burnt smell out. Then she sat on her bed and made a phone call.
Hello, Mr. Frost?
Scarlet? Everything still all right for this evening? How's your mother?
Oh, it's all under control.
Which was what her mother had said when she had asked.
Mr. Frost, how long have you lived at your house?
How long? About, well, 4 months now.
How did you find it?
Estate agent's window. It was empty and I could afford it. Well, more or less. Well, I wanted something within walking distance of the graveyard, and this was perfect.
Mr. Frost.
Scarlet wondered how to say it. And then just said it.
About 13 years ago, 3 people were murdered in your house. The Dorian family.
There was a silence at the other end of the phone.
Mr. Frost, are you there?
Still here, Scarlet. Sorry, not the sort of thing you expect to hear. It's an old house. I mean, you expect things to happen a long time ago, but not... Well, what happened?
Scarlet wondered how much she could tell him.
There was a little piece on it. In an old newspaper. It only gave the address and nothing else. I don't know how they died or anything.
Well, good Lord.
Mr. Frost sounded more intrigued by the news than Scarlet could have expected.
This, young Scarlet, is where we local historians come into our own. Leave it with me. I'll find out everything I can and report back.
Thank you.
I assume this phone call is because if Noona thought there were murders going on in my home, even 13-year-old ones, you'd never be allowed to see me or the graveyard again, so Suppose I won't mention it unless you do.
Thank you, Mr. Frost.
See you at 7. With chocolates.
Dinner was remarkably pleasant. The burnt smell had gone from the kitchen. The chicken was good. The salad was better. The roast potatoes were too crispy, but a delighted Mr. Frost had proclaimed that this was precisely the way he liked them, and had taken a second helping. The flowers were popular. The chocolates, which they had for dessert, were perfect. And Mr. Frost sat and talked, then watched television with them until about 10 p.m. when he said that he needed to get home.
Time, tide, and historical research wait for no man.
He shook Noona's hand with enthusiasm, winked at Scarlet conspiratorially, and was out the door. Scarlet tried to find Bod in her dreams that night. She thought of him as she went to sleep, imagined herself walking the graveyard looking for him. But when she did dream, it was of wandering around Glasgow city centre with her friends from her old school. They were hunting for a specific street, but all they found was a succession of dead ends, one after another. Deep beneath the hill in Krakow, in the deepest vault, beneath the caves they call the Dragon's Den, Miss Lupescu stumbled and fell. Silas crouched beside her and cradled Miss Lupescu's head in his hands. There was blood on her face, and some of it was hers.
You must leave me. Save the boy.
She was halfway now, halfway between grey wolf and woman, but her face was a woman's face.
No, I won't leave you.
Behind him, Kandar cradled its piglet like a child might hold a doll. The mummy's left wing was shattered, and it would never fly again, but its bearded face was implacable.
They will come back, Silas. Too soon, the sun will rise.
Then we must deal with them before they are ready to attack. Can you stand?
Da, I am one of the hounds of God. I will stand.
She lowered her face into the shadows, flexed her fingers. When she raised her head again, it was a wolf's head. She put her front paws down on the rock and laboriously pushed herself up into a standing position. A grey wolf, bigger than a bear, her coat and muzzle flecked with blood. She threw back her head and howled a howl of fury and of challenge. Her lips curled back from her teeth, and she lowered her head once more.
Now we end this.
Late on Sunday afternoon, the telephone rang. Scarlet was sitting downstairs, laboriously copying faces from the manga she had been reading onto scrap paper. Her mother picked up the phone.
Funny, we were just talking about you.
Although they hadn't been.
It was wonderful. I had the best time. Honestly, it was no trouble. The chocolates, they were perfect, just perfect. I told Scarlet to tell you. Any time you want a good dinner, you just let me know. Scarlet? Yes, she's here. I'll put her on. Scarlet!
I'm just here, Mum. You don't have to shout.
She took the phone.
Mr. Frost?
Scarlet, the thing we were talking about, the thing that happened in my house, you can tell this friend of yours that I found out. Listen, when you said a friend of yours, did you mean it in the sense of we're actually talking about you? Or Is there a real person, if it's not a personal question?
I've got a real friend who wants to know.
Her mother shot her a puzzled look.
Tell your friend that I did some digging. Not literally, more like rummaging. Well, a fair amount of actual looking around. And I think I might have unearthed some very real information. Stumbled over something hidden. Well, not something I think we should spread around. I found things out.
Like what?
Look, don't think I'm mad. But, well, as far as I can tell, three people were killed. One of them, the baby, I think, wasn't. It wasn't a family of three. It was a family of four. Only three of them died. Tell him to come and see me, your friend. I'll fill him in.
I'll tell him.
She put down the phone, her heart beating like a snare. Bod walked down the narrow stone stairs for the first time in 6 years. His footsteps echoed in the chamber inside the hill. He reached the bottom of the steps and waited for the sleer to manifest. And he waited and waited, but nothing appeared. Nothing whispered. Nothing moved. He looked around the chamber, untroubled by the deep darkness, seeing it as the dead see. He walked over to the altar stone set in the floor where the cup and the brooch and the stone knife sat. He reached down and touched the edge of the knife. It was sharper than he had expected, and it nicked the skin of his finger.
It is the treasure of the sleer.
But it sounded smaller than he remembered, more hesitant.
You're the oldest thing here. I came to talk to you. I want advice.
A pause.
Nothing comes to the sleer for advice. The sleer guards, the sleer waits.
I know, but Silas isn't here, and I don't know who else to talk to.
Nothing was said, just a silence in reply that echoed of dust and loneliness.
I don't know what to do. I think I can find out about who killed my family. Who wanted to kill me? It means leaving the graveyard, though.
The sleer said nothing. Smoke tendrils twined slowly around the inside of the chamber.
I'm not frightened of dying. It's just so many people I care for have spent so much time keeping me safe, teaching me, protecting me.
Again, silence.
I have to do this on my own.
Yes.
That's all then. Sorry I bothered you.
It whispered into Bod's head. Then, in a voice that was a sleek, insinuating glide,
the sleer was set to guard the treasure.
No.
Will you be our master?
I'm afraid not.
If you were our master, we could hold you in our coils forever. If you were our master, we would keep you safe and protect. End of time, and never let you endure the dangers of the world.
I am not your master.
No.
Bod felt the sleer writhing through his mind.
There.
and his mind was empty, and the room was empty, and Bod was alone. Bod walked back up the stairs, carefully yet quickly. He had come to a decision and needed to act fast, while the decision still burned in his mind. Scarlet was waiting for him on the bench by the chapel.
Well?
I'll do it. Come on.
Side by side, they walked the path down to the graveyard gates.